Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 11, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Kimsuka Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha uses the metaphor of a swift pair of messengers to emphasize the importance of right meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Did everybody experience a pleasant abiding during that meditation?
Yes. Yes.
The fourth jhana. Mm-hmm. There's nothing mysterious or unattainable about it, but I won't talk much about that tonight. The Kimsuka Sutta, a.k.a. a swift pair of messengers, the Buddha uses the metaphor of a swift pair of messengers to define the two aspects of right meditation, shamatha and vipassana. The only meditation method the Buddha ever taught was shamatha vipassana. Shamatha means to quiet the mind or develop a tranquil mind by being mindful of the breath. And vipassana means to gain insight. But it's a very specific insight. It's insight into the three marks of existence, into the impermanence of all things, the not-self characteristic, anatta. And due to a misunderstanding of the first two, we create and personalize life, which creates ongoing distraction and disappointing experiences known as dukkha. The emphasis on both of these characteristics, shamatha and vipassana, quiet in the mind and gaining insight, are reflected in each and every one of the Buddha's teachings and in the overall context of the Buddha's Dhamma, meaning from dependent origination and leading to the Four Noble Truths. When it's applied, when shamatha vipassana meditation is developed within that framework, it becomes obvious that there's nothing singularly specific about just quieting the mind or just gaining insight, because that in itself becomes a distraction and in essence becomes a separate practice from what the Buddha taught. And a good example, not to put them down, one of the major movements in modern Buddhism is called the Insight Movement. And I've been on a couple of their training retreats. And the beginning of the retreat is usually a day and a half or two spent on just quieting the mind, and then for the rest of the retreat, whether it's another 5 days or 7 days, depending on the length of the retreat, then you just get into that quiet space and look for insight within your own mind. Of course, the Buddha never taught just that. He always taught that each meditation method should have both of those components, and this sutta explains it beautifully, and that insight is gained not just in meditation. In fact, it's rarely in meditation that we'll recognize insight except the insight gained to recognizing the impermanence of our thoughts and feelings. It's off our cushion as we integrate the Eightfold Path that we gain true insight into the three marks of existence. And so often meditation methods that are taught separate from what the Buddha taught are also taught separate from an Eightfold Path. In other words, it's almost taught that there's meditation, and then if you're interested, you can look at this stuff over here, rather than a completely integrated practice as the Buddha teaches. The Kimsuka Sutta. Two monks of the Buddha Sangha were talking. One asked the other, "To what extent is one's vision said to be well purified?" "Well, when one knows as it actually is, the origination and the passing away of the sixth sense base, it is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified." Of course, you have to know some of the Buddha's other teachings and how he references the sixth sense base. It is at that point of contact with the world, our five senses, our five physical senses, and the sixth sense of ongoing thinking, in this case rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that we interpret and perceive what is occurring. And if we know that what we're to be interpreting and perceiving is to gain insight into the impermanence of all things and the not-self characteristic that is part of that perception, then all we're doing is being stuck in that feedback loop that the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta. Is that clear what I just said? I think I might have.
Yeah.
complicated it. So in other words, in order to apply right meditation and understand the impermanence at the sixth sense base, we have to understand why, and that's gaining insight into these three marks. It is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified. Dissatisfied with this answer, he asks another monk the same question. When one knows as it actually is the origination and the passing away of the five clinging aggregates, it is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified. A different answer, but also consistent with the Buddhist teaching, isn't it? It's just that this is how that particular Dhamma practitioner is applying impermanence, whether it's through the sixth sense base or the five clinging aggregates. We recognize that all of this is impermanent. Still dissatisfied, he asks another monk the same question. And this other monk answers, when one knows as it actually is, the origination and the passing away of the four great elements of earth, fire, wind, and water, it is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified. Another way of saying that is understanding the impermanence of physical form, both your physical form and the physical form in the world. Still dissatisfied, he asks another monk the same question. Well, when one knows as it actually is that all conditioned things are subject to cessation, it is to this extent that one's vision is said to be well purified. That's also in reference to what Kandana said when he first heard the Buddha's teaching, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. This is really expressing a more broad and profound understanding of the nature of impermanence, but still seeing it from the point of view that this Dhamma practitioner gained the most insight to. Still dissatisfied, he seeks the Buddha. Should have done this in the first place. He tells him of the answers to his questions. The Buddha replies, friends, it is as if a man had never seen a certain tree that changes appearance often. A difficult to describe tree, a riddle tree. There's also a sutta on the riddle tree that's similar to this, called the riddle tree sutta. He would ask someone to describe a riddle tree. They say that the tree is black as a burnt stump. This is how the tree looked at the time. Dissatisfied with this answer, they ask another to describe a riddle tree. They tell him that the tree has no bark and its pods explode. Of course, this is just how the tree looked at the time. Dissatisfied with that answer, they ask another to describe a riddle tree. They tell him that this tree has thick foliage with dense shade. Of course, this is how the tree looked at the time. In this way, what these people of integrity were focused on when their vision became well purified is the way that they answered. Makes sense, doesn't it? So it's not just one or the other, though. The Buddha is also emphasizing that you need to see the whole tree in order to understand and get the riddle to it. Suppose, friend, that there was a royal frontier fortress with strong walls and ramparts and six gates. It would be a wise, experienced, intelligent gatekeeper to keep out those he didn't know and to let in those he did. The Buddha's speaking of refined mindfulness, isn't he? To have that refined mindfulness and a measure of concentration so that we know what to let in, especially as part of what to let in as our Dhamma practice. It's a self-referential ego self that is always grasping at everything and has no discernment and practices no restraint, right? That's what the Buddha is referring to here. A swift pair of messengers coming from the east would say to the gatekeeper, where, my good man, is the commander of this fortress? He would say, he is, sir, sitting in the central square. The swift pair of messengers delivering their accurate report to the commander of the fortress would then go back by the route by which they had come. Then a swift pair of messengers coming from the west, and then the north, and then the south, would say to the gatekeeper, where, my good man, is the commander of this fortress? And he would say, there he is, sir, sitting in the central square. The swift pair of messengers delivering their accurate report to the commander of the fortress would then go back by the route which they had come. The Buddha continues, I have given you this simile, friend, to convey a message, and the message is this. The fortress stands for this body, composed of the four great elements, born of mother and father and nourished with rice and barley gruel, subject to constant rubbing and abrasion, breaking and falling apart. The sixth gate stands for the six internal sense media, the sixth sense base. The gatekeeper stands for mindfulness. So obviously, if we don't have mindfulness, refined mindfulness, there's nothing to stand guard at the gate, isn't there? And then anything is possible, and any and ongoing distraction occurs, doesn't it? Without restraint. Again, that's so antithetical to a self-referential ego personality that's constantly grasping, rooted in craving, and rooted in clinging to what it's craving, especially once it gets it. The gatekeeper stands for mindfulness. The swift pair of messengers stands for tranquility and insight, shamatha and vipassana. The commander of the fortress stands for consciousness. The central square stands for the four great elements: the earth property, the liquid property, the fire property, and the wind property. And think about the visual here. The commander is sitting in the central square. He has positioned his form in the place that he is most likely to receive the information that he needs to develop understanding of the three marks of existence. He has united his mind and the body, using this metaphor, by establishing himself in the central square. The route by which the swift pair of messengers come from stands for the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. That's the end of the sutta. Isn't it remarkable, a sutta like this that uses such a powerful metaphor to bring everything right back, including right meditation, to the Eightfold Path, and concluding with that? Using this powerful metaphor that we can all relate to, and then tracing the route that the messengers took, or I shouldn't say tracing it, using the Eightfold Path to describe the path that these swift pair of messengers took to the central square, to awakening. And so there can be no ambiguity here then, that this is a complete practice. I find this is a sutta that I've referred to often. I came to it a long time ago, but I think it's one of the most powerful suttas in just keeping our Dhamma practice well focused and really understanding why we meditate. Because even with even what you learn here, only from the Sutta Pitaka, it's still easy to fall into different practices that our mind wants to do. Establish ourselves in non-physical realms, or start using meditation to even analyze the Eightfold Path. This has come up a few times. It's not the time to do that. You can certainly think about and contemplate the Eightfold Path outside of a meditation practice, but meditation is for deepening concentration. And through that deepening concentration, we're able to develop refined mindfulness that holds in mind the entire Eightfold Path. So, two talks tonight. Rather than just ask for questions, just go around the room. It's just the two of us. So, Matt, good to see you tonight. Glad you made it.
Here. Thanks to see you, Kev. I like this. We've done this several times over the years.
Yeah. And
it really is. I almost didn't hear these things in it when I first heard the sutta. So, that's a testament to how this practice of the Eightfold Path has gotten deeper, gotten more solid, and it's a complete teaching. This teaching in itself, so
yeah,
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And that's just how it is. As we develop we broaden our context, we see things that we haven't seen before because we know how to apply it. This sutta to someone who may just coming to Buddhism and comes across this, it wouldn't have that kind of a meaning. It might point you in a direction of what is the Eightfold Path, but if you don't understand dependent origination and the entire Four Noble Truths, you really wouldn't know how to apply it. But again, the Buddha didn't teach anything out of context. Everything relates to that. Thank you. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you too. It does refer to the other teachings. It is dependent origination. One of the monks refers to dependent origination.
Yeah.
And the other refers to five being aggregates, and then it just brings it all together. So it's really cool. I was at a bookstore today, and I was thinking, well, let me read something else about Buddhism. Let me just see what I can find. And I looked through the shelf that had 50 books on it, and I thought, after I was looking at that, I thought, I'm not sure if that's going to help me if I get any of these books, yeah. You know, and I just thought, let me just stick with the basic teaching and keep coming back and come back to the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah. Wow. And you practiced wise restraint, didn't you?
Yeah.
It's just as important to, again, I say this a lot to Buddha because the Buddha does, it's just as important to know what it is and as what it isn't. Did you see my book up there, by the way?
I didn't see it.
And that is, I have a library of over 300 books on Buddhism. And we talked about this a couple of years ago. Why don't you bring them here and we'll have a library? And I thought I wouldn't do that because I don't want to confuse people with it. I found a place to donate it out in Knoxville, so I don't just toss them. But it really is amazing the amount of Buddhist literature out there, and hardly any of it is based on what the Buddha actually taught. It's understandable, but it's also unfortunate, isn't it?
Yeah.
But so you went home and you read Becoming Buddha again.
Mm-hmm.
Good. And I'll be putting out a few other books one of these days. So I won't comment further on that.
Well, I like the, in the line where it says something like, when seeing things as it is, the sixth sense base is clear, something like that.
Yeah.
The five putting aggregates are, it's ultimately practical. That's what he's saying.
That's right.
That when seen as it is,
yeah. The arising and the passing away.
Yeah.
In all of these things, all these different themes, even you have to, you don't have to. The insight is to the impermanence of all of these things, isn't it? And so, ultimately, we get to the point when we truly understand at a penetrative level the impermanence of all things. We realize that, or the ultimate realization is that it's my thoughts that are impermanent, and the objects that I have in my thoughts, the fabrications that are impermanent. And that's what led to Khandana's great understanding. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. It's not just, in fact, it's only secondarily a comment on the world at large and the impermanence of all physical objects. It's an internal understanding that all of these thoughts that I've been so enamored with my whole life, hoping to make them permanent in the world, hoping to manifest it. Think about the whole notion of creative visualization. It goes back to the hippie days. I think about something long and hard enough, I can make it manifest. I tried that, especially when the rent was due. I really tried it. I mean, just honestly, I did. And it seemed entirely practical because I needed money. So let me focus on a big pot of gold. And once in a while, something would happen that brought money in. I'd say, wow, that really worked. The point is, those are always self-referential and objectified, always. When I let go of the need for anything to be any different than it is, stop taking things personal, because I understand the impermanence in what I'm grasping after or clinging to, simply let it go, peace prevails. It's not a secret. There's nothing hidden there. It's entirely practical. Just to take that a little bit further, the Buddha often taught that we need four things. We need food, shelter, medicine, and clothing. And those things are readily available. It's when we want more food than we need, fancier clothes than we need, instant healing right now, we get into spiritual healing, food, clothing, or the biggest house on the block, that we get into trouble. But the four basic needs that we have are almost always readily available. And when we undertake the pursuit of them without eye making, there's no stress involved. And so it doesn't matter whether we find ourselves in a position that we're making millions of dollars a year or just getting by, because it's in proper perspective, there's no eye making in it or anywhere in between. We're at peace no matter what's occurring. And there's nothing wrong with being in a position where you got $1 million coming in, or millions and billions. It doesn't matter, as long as you're not giving up your mind to do it. Again, that's the whole teaching on impermanence. Any other questions or comments? It was a great comment. Thank you. And Kevin, too. All right, we'll finish with metta as we always do. I don't really have any announcements that you guys haven't heard yet, so we'll just finish it up. So find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.